The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Welcome to Undisclosed. My name is Amelia McDonald Perry, and I'm an investigator, journalist, and occasional podcaster living in Baltimore. You may remember me from Undisclosed series about Freddie Gray, which came out in 2017, and last year I hosted The State versus Keith Davis Jr., the podcast's first time covering a pretrial case. This Sunday, June 7th, is the five-year anniversary of Keith Davis Jr.'s near-deadly encounter with the Baltimore police. On that day in 2015, Keith became the first person shot by police after Freddie Gray's death and the subsequent rioting during the Baltimore uprising. 5 years since he was misidentified as an armed robber, chased by police into an auto repair garage, and shot at over 30 times. 5 years since he took a .40 caliber bullet to his right cheek, felt it shatter his jaw, and then lodge in his neck. 5 years since he survived and a target was placed on his back. Keith has been prosecuted 5 times total since June 7, 2015, including 4 trials for the murder of Kevin Jones, which occurred earlier that same day. After 2 hung juries and 1 overturned conviction, Keith went to trial for a 4th time for the murder in July 2019 and was ultimately found guilty. In the last update episode of this Keith Davis Jr. series, which aired in August, I told you about some of the issues that Keith's defense had raised in their motion for a new trial. This episode will address the outcome of that hearing and some of the ups and downs that have happened since. In Baltimore, and probably many other places, the motion for a new trial hearing is usually scheduled for the same day as sentencing. If and when the motion is denied, the court can move right along to the punishment stage. On the rare occasion a new trial is granted, then that's it, hearing's over. There's no one to sentence since the conviction has been vacated and the defendant is back to being presumed innocent. These motions, like I said, are rarely successful. The judge who presided over the trial is usually asked to reconsider decisions they made during the course of the proceeding and admit that their own error in some way contributed to an unfair outcome. There are exceptions, of course, but the proceeding can feel like a dog and pony show when the judge's denial is all but certain. Nevertheless, it's a necessary step in preserving the issues so they can be argued on appeal. Keith's hearing began on a Friday morning, February 28, 2020. Judge Sylvester Cox's courtroom was packed with people, including Kevin Jones's father and several aunts and cousins. I was sitting with Keith's wife, Kelly Davis, and the group of supporters she's rallied around them, better known as Team Keith. The hearing was expected to take a full day, but there was a hiccup. Kelly noticed as soon as Keith was brought into the courtroom that he wasn't looking so well, kind of ashy in the face and short of breath. His attorney noticed too. And then during the lunch break, he had a full-blown asthma attack, and corrections had to take him back to the jail so he could go down to medical. Judge Cox continued the hearing until the following Monday, March 2nd. It turned out to be an auspicious day. Keith's attorney, public defender Deborah Levy, argued 8 issues in her motion for a new trial, including 6 allegations of egregious error and prosecutorial misconduct by Assistant State's Attorney Patrick Seidel during closing arguments. Each of these violations, Levy argued, substantially prejudiced and interfered with Keith's right to due process and effective assistance of counsel, and cumulatively would not have been cured by any one instruction, thereby entitling Keith to a new and fair trial. I discussed several of these issues in my last update episode, which aired back in August, but here's the full list of errors. 1. Seidel referred to an unindicted crime, for which there was no evidentiary support, by suggesting, for the first time ever, that the murder of Kevin Jones was also a robbery. 2. Seidel altered photo and video evidence, then presented it to the jury through PowerPoint, and finally refused to enter that PowerPoint into evidence. 3. Seidel denigrated the defendant by referring to Keith as Mr. Howard County. 4. He incorrectly stated the presumption of innocence and shifted the burden of proof when he said that Keith was not, quote, presumed innocent, but, quote, presumed not guilty. 5. Seidel admitted irrelevant and inflammatory evidence, including allegations about Keith's relationship with his then-girlfriend and now-wife. And finally, 6. Seidel grossly misrepresented the DNA evidence to the jury, which was not entered into evidence or testified about during the actual trial. Levy even had an expert witness testify about this last one. Carl Reich, a DNA analyst and molecular biologist who previously signed an affidavit calling Seidel's statements about DNA not even close to accurate and patently false. In his testimony, Reich said Seidel's claims about complex DNA mixtures were, quote, inaccurate, and his assertion that fingerprint evidence is better and more unique than DNA is, quote, simply not true and just wrong. Seidel, who graduated from a fourth-tier Roman Catholic law school sanctioned by the American Bar Association for its lax admission standards, went on to question whether Reich's exemplary credentials qualified him as an expert. I have to say, it was positively Thuruvian. Quote, you know I was the prosecutor who made those statements, right? It was like Reich was supposed to apologize for being smarter and right. Reich didn't miss a beat. Yeah, I figured. I guffawed. I actually laughed out loud. The attorneys on both sides have a lot more freedom during closing arguments than, say, examining witnesses. This is their only opportunity to piece together all of the evidence and testimony that has already been put in front of the jury and to sell their version of the case. Judge Cox overruled more than 20 of Levy's objections during Seidel's closing, including her objections to these 6 issues. He often added, "It's argument, not evidence," referring to the fact that the jury is told to disregard closing arguments during deliberations. Their verdict must only be based on the evidence and witness testimony they heard during the trial, and not the attorney's interpretation of it. That may be the instruction, but how likely are they to follow it, or even recognize when they're not following it? Studies have shown that jurors are paying the most attention and are most engaged during closing arguments. It's argument, not evidence. Doesn't mean anything goes. Seidel seemed to know what he could get away with. I am very careful with my words, Your Honor. And so was Cox. He stuck by his rulings and denied the defense's motion for a new trial, upholding Keith's conviction. But the day still wasn't over yet. In January 2020, the Court of Appeals issued a reported opinion vacating a conviction for another Baltimore murder that occurred in the summer of 2015. And there's reason to believe that the court's decision in Cazotti v. State will also return Keith Davis Jr.'s presumption of innocence. In 2017, when Shivangu Cazotti went to trial for the murder of Brandon Smith, his attorneys requested that the circuit court ask during voir dire whether any prospective jurors were unwilling or unable to follow jury instructions on the presumption of innocence, the burden of proof, and the defendant's right to testify. Their requested questions were denied and Kazadi was ultimately convicted. Around the same time, in nearby Anne Arundel County, the attorney for Joseph Patrick Sewell ran into the same issue at his murder trial. A Maryland Bar Association special committee, which included a long list of prosecutors, defense attorneys, and judges, had published a book of model voir dire questions, and Sewell's attorney requested that they be used. The judge in his case also said no way. Keith's attorney, Debbie Levy, told me she requests voir dire questions about the presumption of innocence, the burden of proof, and the defendant's right to testify in all of her cases, including Keith's.
So every jurisdiction or every state is different. Some states allow for something called attorney-led voir dire, where you get to ask the questions, a lawyer gets to ask the questions to the pool, the prospective jurors, and then based on their answers, you ask specific follow-up questions. Maryland is really stringent. So the only way that we have access in Maryland to exposing potential jurors' biases towards the defendant or the charges or witnesses is through court-led voir dire. So you're really, your opportunity to expose as much potential bias as possible, which, as you know, when there's a biased juror, you have interfered with the defendant's right to a fair trial, right? The defendant is entitled to an unbiased jury.
While judges in other jurisdictions have been willing, in Maryland, she, like the attorneys for Kazadi and Sewell, has consistently struck out when she's asked for those questions.
In Maryland, they happen to be rejected each and every time. And the theory behind rejecting them is that they're covered by the jury instructions. And our argument for asking for them anyway is jury instructions do not at all reach this issue. The instructions are given after the jury's been selected.
Oh, so, right.
You don't get to probe their understanding of these very complicated and fundamental principles of criminal justice in our entire country and certainly in our state. You don't even get to probe these issues with the jury beforehand. And the judge, when he denied it, said, no, it's covered in my instructions. But really, and the state's going to argue or did argue that this is a technicality. I think they used that word. This is not a technicality. Whether you understand fundamental principles of criminal law in Maryland or anywhere. And these are like really hard concepts to grasp. What exactly does it mean to have the burden of proof? Most everybody wants to hear from the defendant. Human beings have a curiosity, I should say, and people want to know the defendant's story. And I want to hear from the prospective jurors. Are you going to be upset if you need to hear from them?
Okay, so what gives? I talked to Steve Klepper, a Maryland appellate attorney who blogs about the Court of Appeals and recently worked on the Sewell case.
There was a 1964 case called Twining versus Dane, and it held that questions to that effect were, to use their exact word, inappropriate. Twining was so old that the crime at issue was the crime of bastardy. That is impregnating a woman and then refusing to marry her.
Wow.
So, yes, it's a different era.
So these questions about presumption of innocence, et cetera, were not mandated, but they also weren't banned.
Yes,
banned is
correct.
So it was up to the judge's discretion. So if a defense attorney wanted these questions, the judge could grant or deny. And in denying, sometimes a judge might cite Twining, because Twining is an example of a case where the judge found those questions inappropriate.
Yes, and it's a funny thing because, you know, one of the reasons that I brought this to the Court of Appeals' attention, I said, is that the trial judges are receiving mixed signals because Twining didn't just affirm that it was inappropriate. The court said it was. Was inappropriate. And so the implication in 1964 was that judges shouldn't be asking these questions at all. It could change from courtroom to courtroom whether you would receive that instruction when you requested it. And our argument was that, well, Twining said that these were not commonly used questions, and now we were able to say, well, actually, it is commonly used. It said it didn't fit with the purpose of voir dire in Maryland. It's limited to exercising challenges for cause where a lawyer can articulate, this is why I think a juror is biased. It is not allowed to be used for so-called flight, where you get a certain number, the state defense saying, I said juror, I don't have to give a reason.
Right.
And then the final aspect was they noted that back in 1964, jury instructions were advisory. The Maryland Constitution says that jury is the ultimate judge of the law, and it wasn't until later that the Court of Appeal said, well, yes, but it's not consonant with the federal constitution to tell jurors that the judge's instructions are only advisory and the jury is the ultimate arbiter, because that can take away the defendant's right to have the jury apply the beyond reasonable doubt standard.
Right.
Very arcane, complicated stuff.
Both Kazadi and Sewell filed appeals arguing, amongst other case-specific issues, that the circuit court had abused its discretion by declining to ask prospective jurors their requested voir dire questions. While each was waiting for the Court of Special Appeals to issue a ruling, Keith was in the circuit court for murder trials 2 and 3. Then in January 2019, the Court of Special Appeals affirmed Sewell's conviction. A few weeks later, in early February, Kazadi received the same bad news. COSA cited the Court of Appeals precedent in Twining versus State as the reason for the denials. Sewell's attorney, Erica Souter, a friend of Undisclosed, asked Klepper for his help in getting the case before the Court of Appeals.
I'm an appeals lawyer, and I will handle anything, and including civil, criminal, whatever. Mm-hmm. And when I take these cases, my only goal is to represent my client's interest. And if that requires me to try to change the law, I'll try to change the law. And it's my job to make arguments why it's the general public interest, why my client should win, why the law should be changed to benefit my client.
After an appeal has been denied by COSA, the attorneys have 15 days to file a petition for writ of cert with the Court of Appeals. The state's highest court has discretion to choose which cases to address, and they want it to be worth their while. Klepper believed the voir dire issue was strong in the Sewell case, and it was time to take tired-ass Twining down.
I think this can grab the court's attention. Now, a problem was my client's case was an unreported opinion. The Court of Special Appeals, our intermediate appellate court, only reports a small number of its opinions each year, and the odds of getting review in the Court of Appeals are lower if your case is unreported. And they're also lower if you are a private practitioner. When I'm a private practitioner, if my client hires me to file a petition for certiorari for the review in our high court, and I've got good faith grounds to do it, I do it. But the Office of the Public Defender is, they've got an excellent appellate division, and they are selective in a way that private counsel, to a degree private counsel, can't be. And so there is a certain weight when the Office of Public Defender is the one to ask.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a few days after I got the case, I think it was February 4th, the Kazadi opinion comes down. That was an Office of Public Defender case, and it was reported.
Mm-hmm.
And the opinion said, if we're going to change the law of Twining, the Court of Appeals has to be the one to do it. And so I called the Office of Public Defender, and I said, would you please petition for cert in the Kazadi case? The Office of Public Defender had burned many times. They had tried to get Twining overturned. It had not worked. They had given up. And I said, I'm going for it. Would you please do that? Because I think it'll help my client.
So you needed a case to kind of be the vehicle for this, to pursue or to get this in front of the Court of Appeals. And Kazadi seemed like a solid case to do it.
Kazadi seemed like a solid case. And at the very least, what it could be would – you know, the Court of Appeals could take either one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what, you know, I'm only here for my client, and I think that, you know, a lot of lawyers might bristle at the idea, well, you know, the Court of Appeals will probably grant the Office of Public Defender case if it's up there and, you know, take away my opportunity to get paid to write a brief and argue and get the glory of arguing in our high court. But to me, it was a simple matter of, it's in my client's interest for the OPD to petition Cazotti, I'm going to encourage them to do it. We filed our petition of 6 days before the OPD's. We included a footnote saying, we understand the OPD is petitioning for this issue in the Cazotti case as well.
So you were filing in Sewell.
We were filing in the Sewell case.
Okay, and then the OPD was filing in the Cazotti case, and essentially you were raising the same issue.
The same issue. We had different arguments that we offered, but it was the same basic issue. They received our petitions the same day. They voted on them the same day. And it comes down, and not a surprise, the court grants cert in Cazotti and takes no action on Sewell's petition. So they're holding it while they decide Cazotti.
Just to be clear so people understand, in terms of what it means when the Court of Appeals grants cert,
that means
they're not making a decision yet, but what they're saying is they're going to consider the arguments.
Yes.
In that case. Got it.
The standard is that review is desirable and in the public interest.
Basically, and what interests them.
Yes.
Like, yeah.
The entire state was on notice as of March 2019 that the Court of Appeals was looking at whether it was going to mandate this question.
When Keith's case went to trial in July 2019, Levy was certainly on notice that the Court of Appeals was considering a challenge to Twining, and their decision had the potential to change the law. She would have asked for the voir dire questions regardless, but denying her request now came with the risk of reversible error.
Mm-hmm. Did the state have an opportunity to object to certain questions you want to ask?
Yes. Yeah, so prior to trial, we have a hearing. So we submit our voir dire in advance. The state submits their proposed voir dire. And then the court goes through all of it to sort of marry it down to what the court's going to ask. So we had a hearing where I asked for those questions, and then you have to preserve it. In other words, I said I would like to have questions, you know, 4, 5, 9, 10, and the court and the state, in this case, objected. Now, they didn't have to object. And I've made this argument before. I mean, I said, Your Honor, I have the transcripts on the 12th. You know, there's a case that's pending cert, and we think this may come down our way, and it's likely to result in reversible error if we don't ask these questions. Not only do we want to ask these questions, but we're not sure that's a really good idea not to let us. In this particular case, we're really feeling like, you know, based on the oral argument and the questions being asked at oral argument, I mean, we weren't fortune tellers, but the fact that the Court of Appeals was even looking at it and considering it meant you've got a chance at winning that argument, and which we believe is a really important argument on fundamental principles. This is not just a small thing. And because our jury selection is so limited in Maryland, any opportunity to be able to widen the probe toward fairness and unbiased jurors is a big deal for us. So
right.
We were on notice, and so we referenced that this decision was coming down, and the state pulled up the opinion from the Court of Special Appeals and said, Judge, you know, we actually argued about whether or not how this was going to roll out.
So much for being cautious with his words. Seidel's objection could ultimately cost him the whole damn case.
No, we actually could have predicted, and we actually
yeah.
did predict it. And, I mean, that is really the state would have made themselves if they had not been so insistent on digging in to everything we asked. I mean, you would really think, you know, that there are many times when you are sitting in trial and you raise a very important issue as a defense attorney, and I have had prosecutors say, Judge, we do not want reversible error. We're going to agree to what defense counsel is asking for, because we want to prevent this from coming back. And that is not an uncommon experience. So they certainly had the opportunity to say, you know, Your Honor, we don't know how this is going to come down. We're not 100% confident that we're going to win. So why don't we just give those questions? There's no harm in reaching a fair jury. I mean, really, there was very little harm in just letting us ask those questions.
Yeah. I mean, if this case was on cert, they should have. Yeah, it seems to me that it was actually really, frankly, stupid move to be so insistent.
But the decision certainly did not help them from preventing a new trial, right? So
right.
they, you know, and so maybe in hindsight, when something's pending on appeal, maybe they'll be more cautious in the future. So So we made this record, and then at the then you have to preserve it again. So really, that's a super hard thing to do, is your trial lawyer is preserving the record. And so because you have to bring it up again, when the jury was, the judge asked the jury all the questions, they bring you up to the bench and the judge says, okay, is there anything else? And I said, except for the other questions I have previously asked or that this court denied, we have no other questions, or something to that effect. And the judge said, your objection is noted. It is preserved. So then you could argue there's no other reason for me to bring it back. He's acknowledged it. The court said it's preserved. Then there's another opportunity to preserve it when the panel is selected, and then the jury says, is everybody okay with the panel? But the court did not ask if we were okay with the panel here, because we had used all of our strikes. So we didn't, there was really no way, there was would have been no remedy if we hadn't been. So the court didn't ask and we didn't answer. Once the court says it's preserved, it's preserved.
After Keith was convicted last year, Levy had 10 days to file a motion for a new trial. The Court of Appeals hadn't yet heard oral arguments in the Kazadi case, and a decision could be a ways off. Keith's sentencing hearing was originally scheduled for November. Had it actually gone forward then, I'm not sure where his case would be. The hearing was postponed until February, though, for reasons that are totally unrelated. So when the Court of Appeals issued their opinion granting a new trial in Kazadi versus State on January 24th, Keith's motion for a new trial was still pending.
So I did do a motion for new trial within 10 days of the verdict. So we got that in. And then you have up to 1 year if there's something you couldn't have known about previously to file the motion for new trial. So when the opinion came out on January 24th, we filed a supplement to the motion for new trial. In other words, an additional ground.
Right.
Kazadi came out today. It's after the 10-day period, but we couldn't have known about it because it wasn't released, and we're adding that to the reasons we want a new trial. And then we quickly got that in and attached a copy of Kazadi, and then had a little bit more time to reflect and look at the opinion, and you can't help but look at it, and it says, the court held that the ruling, quote, shall apply prospectively, and that, quote, our holding exclusively applies to this case and future trials, and this opinion should not be considered as giving rise to any grounds for relief in cases in which voir dire occurred before today, i.e. cases in which trial courts operated under the assumption that Twining remains the law. So, of course, we saw that.
Mm-hmm.
But we knew that that was not a correct statement of the law.
Going into the motion for a new trial hearing and having seen the opinion and how it was phrased, were you concerned that from the jump that was going to be the basis to reject it?
Well, of course. My colleagues would say to me, how odd it must be for you to go into the trial court and say, the Court of Appeals issued this opinion today, but trust me, the Court of Appeals got this wrong. They didn't mean to say what they said. That's what I had to do. And the reason I knew that is because there's other law in Maryland and in the United States Supreme Court that says prospective, and this is from State versus Daughtry,
mm-hmm.
Which is from 2011, quoting an opinion from 1988, which all goes back to Griffith versus Kentucky, which was released in 1987, and in the United States Supreme Court, and Batson, which was released in 1986. So, and in all of these cases, they say prospective means all other pending cases where the relevant question has been preserved for appellate review. And remember, we argued at the motion for new trial, Judge, you have to trust us, they got it wrong, and we're going to appeal that issue.
So within exactly 1 week after Kazadi was filed, we got on file a supplement, we called it, to the petition, our petition in the Sewell case. And then we simultaneously filed what we called a line with the Court of Appeals in Kazadi saying, hey, just so you know, we just filed this in the Sewell case.
Both Sewell and Kazadi were before the Court of Appeals at the same time. They chose to take up the Kazadi case. They granted a new trial based on the very issue that you had raised in the Sewell case that they did not take up, and that the language used in Kazadi was essentially excluding your client from having the same benefit that he had asked for at the same time. I mean, it seems like so, on a very basic level, yes, it just comes down to fundamental fairness. Why should Kazadi get a benefit that Sewell was standing next to him going, hello, I want the same thing. I'm in the same boat that he is.
Yes. Now, this gets back to the very first thing that I said. If the state had simply agreed that because Sewell and Kazadi were so similarly situated, it should apply to Sewell
mm-hmm.
without getting into anything further. And there just been a line that said this applies to Cazotti and Sewell and no one else.
Right.
That would have been the end of it. And I would not have advocated for anything broader.
Right.
We were arguing that however this comes down, this should apply to Sewell. And here are reasons of general applicability why it should apply to everything else. But, I mean, my only interest was in getting a new trial for Sewell.
Right.
But
right.
The state opposed, and you know, we then filed a quick reply, all getting it in front of the Court of Appeals.
When Keith's sentencing hearing resumed on the morning of March 2nd, 2020, there was still no response from the Court of Appeals. Klepper was holding his breath, waiting to find out whether all of his efforts to change the law would actually apply to his own client. But Levy had every intention of arguing to Judge Cox that the ruling should and would apply to Keith Davis Jr.'s case.
Going into the motion for a new trial hearing and having seen the opinion and how it was phrased, were you concerned that from the jump that was going to be the basis to reject it?
Well, of course. My colleagues would say to me, how odd it must be for you to go into the trial court and say, the Court of Appeals issued this opinion today, but trust me, the Court of Appeals got this wrong. They continue to say what they said. That's what I had to do. And the reason I knew that is because there's other law in Maryland and in the United States Supreme Court that says prospective, and this is from State versus Daughtry, mm-hmm. Which is from 2011, quoting an opinion from 1988, which all goes back to Griffith versus Kentucky, which was released in 1987, and in the United States Supreme Court, and Batson, which was released in 1986. So, and in all of these cases, they say prospective means all other pending cases where the relevant question has been preserved for appellate review. And remember, we argued at the motion for new trial, Judge, you have to trust us, they got it wrong, and we're going to appeal that issue.
Right.
And we're going to show you how decades of law, prospective only means all cases not yet final. And the court, just as we explained to Judge Cox, that this would just be completely and entirely unfair. The Supreme Court said that you couldn't have something called the selective application and exclude other pending cases. The Supreme Court says, as a practical matter, of course, a certiorari court cannot hear each case pending on direct review and apply the new rule, but we fulfill our judicial responsibility by instructing lower courts to apply the new rule retroactively to all cases not yet final. Thus, it is the nature of judicial review that precludes us from simply fishing one case from the stream of appellate review, using it as a vehicle for pronouncing new constitutional standards, and then permitting a stream of similar cases subsequently to flow by, unaffected by that new rule. In this case, clearly the rule, prospective only, means all cases not yet final on appeal. In other words, we just were very confident that that was going to come back. And the state responded that my argument was so preposterous that it didn't even bear a response, didn't even warrant a response. And the court sided with the state that it was a preposterous argument.
That was it. Judge Cox denied the defense's motion for a new trial on every issue Levy had raised and upheld Keith's conviction. After four trials, the state had finally gotten a conviction that would stick, at least for the time being, and Keith would proceed to the sentencing stage. It was a dark afternoon. The murder of Kevin Jones warranted the maximum sentence, recommended Seidel. 20 years for felony handgun use in a crime of violence, 30 years for second-degree murder, to be served consecutively for a total of 50 years in prison. Ideally, one as far away from family as possible. The defendant already calls his wife every day. Seidel's voice was full of disdain. Keith stalked the 25-year-old security guard on his way to work just before dawn on June 7th, 2015. He shot him 11 times in the Pimlico Racetrack parking lot, including once through the top of his head, Seidel said. Another even blew out his front teeth. Quote, "He swallowed the bullet, and we found it in his stomach," Seidel told Judge Cox, as if gruesome details were worth more prison time. While prosecutors often talk about deterrence and rehabilitation when making their sentencing recommendations, Seidel said, in this case, they didn't even come into play. Keith Davis Jr. just deserved to be punished as severely as the law would allow. The family of Kevin Jones wanted it that way. Seidel read aloud a statement from Kevin's maternal aunt, who was present in the courtroom and attended every trial. She got custody of Kevin when he was just a baby. Quote, I made a promise to my sister, who I loved, that I would raise Kevin right and I would protect him, she wrote. I feel like I failed. Seidel dismissed the number of people in the room who were there for Keith as a, quote, campaign. I'm asking Your Honor not to be swayed because they're going to be the loudest voice in the courtroom. Levy gave Judge Cox a binder full of letters from Keith's loved ones and supporters. A few spoke, asking Judge Cox to right the injustice. Levy said, Mr. Davis is an innocent man. He stands here today, convicted of a crime he did not commit. Kelly's young teenage sons, Jaden and Amari, read a letter to the court about how much they love their stepfather, how involved he is in their lives, despite the circumstances. They looked adorably handsome in their court outfits. Kelly always jokes that she somehow gave birth to little Keith. It's true, both boys resemble him, but Jaden is almost the spitting image of Keith when he was a little kid. They are great kids, a direct reflection of their incredible mother, and their stepfather clearly has something to do with it as well. Kelly described Keith as a devoted stepfather who managed to arrange boxing lessons for one of the boys when he was being bullied at school. She told the court that she's in law school and she intends to do her part to, quote, decrease the number of Keith Davis Juniors in the world. She turned to face Seidel next, staring him down. As long as there is breath in my body, I will continue to fight. I will continue to organize. I will continue to advocate until my husband walks across the threshold of my home. Keith also stood up and spoke on his own behalf. He maintained his innocence as he always has. I am not the man I have been painted out to be. A lot of these so-called facts about me aren't facts at all. He said he was no killer. Finally, Judge Cox addressed the courtroom. He acknowledged the controversy surrounding the case and noted the range of voices in the room as unusual for a sentencing hearing. He said, two families are destroyed, one being the victims, one being the defendants. And then, just as he had done the entire time the case was in his hands, Cox, a former Baltimore prosecutor himself, handed down the state's requested sentence. 20 years for felony handgun use in a crime of violence, 30 years for second-degree murder, to be served consecutively, for a total of 50 years. We'll see about that.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
And it was like, you couldn't have written it in a movie that mm-hmm. as soon as the court rejected the argument, sentenced our client to the maximum sentence allowed by law. And I walked out of the side entrance to the Mitchell courthouse, and then I picked up my phone to look at it. As I was exiting the courthouse, as if like the universe all lined up, and this moment in time, I looked at my phone, and the first thing I got was an email from my appellate division saying, Kazadi issued a corrected opinion today. They didn't mean to say what they said. Prospective only means all cases not yet final. I literally hadn't even fully left the courthouse yet.
That's amazing. Did you want to like run back into the courtroom and be like, Judge Cox, wait?
I ran to my office. I like dropped to my knees and started crying. And like sort of like some screaming I think happened. And then I ran outside to see Kelly, to see Mr. Davis's wife, and I gave her a hug, and I mean, I think somebody videotaped me running across
yeah.
the street. Kazadi was corrected today. They meant to say what we said they meant to say. And we were so excited. I've never in my life had anything like that. I mean, when you think about it, the Kazadi opinion was filed, you know, at least a year prior, probably.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was, the opinion came out in January, and we happened to have postponed a hearing on Friday because Mr. Davis fell ill, and Court of Appeals that particular day of all days issues that corrected opinion on that precise point that we just finished arguing that the state called preposterous.
It seems to me that that's a sign that maybe that verdict should be thrown out.
I quickly cranked out a motion to reconsider the motion for trial, and I like physically bolted across the street and filed a copy in the court and hand-delivered a copy to Chambers, and they even let me walk all the way back to Chambers. Like, I opened the door, there's a long hallway, I take a left, I opened the brief to the opinion, and I handed it to the judge's assistant. When you study the law, and you know the law, and you take apart the law, and you pick it apart, you expect the court to do the same. You expect the court to know the law, and it is incredibly frustrating when the law seems very, very clear, and you're arguing a very clear, important point in the law, and folks are disagreeing with you on the
mm-hmm.
bench, that is a really hard pill to swallow. As an academic person who approaches law, that is a tough pill to swallow. So because it doesn't seem like the fair, just, or right thing result when
right.
the law is clear. So where you get this sense of like the water's flowing again, like, okay, cooler heads prevailed, justice prevailed, the right result is going to happen here because that was not right. And there is a really, you have like sort of a very visceral response to when you feel like it's just not right.
Right.
So what happened in that moment was like, okay, like we can relax. The universe is like sort of realigned. This is the right result.
I was thrilled when I heard the news that the opinion in Cassati had been corrected to include all cases pending direct appeal when the order was issued. But it wasn't until I was working on this episode that I really understood how the stars had to align just right for a law this significant to change when and how it did in order for Keith to benefit from it.
It wasn't until I had filed everything I had filed in Sewell that I even found out there was any possible impact on the Keith Davis Jr. case. And I believe it was March 2nd that I discovered that this had been an issue in the hearing that morning.
Deb Levy had been closely following, you know, since March 2019, the developments as far as the Cassati case was concerned. And the language, as you said, seemed to exclude your client, but would also exclude Keith. She was still very much of the opinion that this was going to be something that the Court of Appeals would hopefully very likely change or correct, and then it would. That was an issue that she vociferously argued actually at the motion for a new trial just before sentencing, which was on March 2nd, I would say probably an hour or two after being denied on that very issue. And she saw that the Cassati correction had come out.
Well, I will tell you, if Deb Levy thought it was probable that was going to change, I wasn't necessarily thinking it's so probable. I mean, it's, you know, once it came out and the court said what it said, it's tough. Mm-hmm. And but I am somebody where, you know, I will try the impossible enough times that, you know, the impossible sometimes happens, and maybe this is sort of impossible. But it's tough telling a court this language you used was, you know, it's a mistake.
I think what I mean is that it's not that she necessarily thought that your petition was specifically was going to win, but that because the ruling from the Court of Appeals was so contrary to how they're made and who they apply to, that ultimately whoever was – somebody would be successful getting – the Court of Appeals to recognize that that change to the law had to apply to all cases going forward, but also those people who were in the same position as Cassati was at the time that they made that ruling.
Yeah.
That anything other than that would be fundamentally unfair. I mean, she could have just been feigning confidence, but I bought it.
You know, there's always the difference between, you know, what you think is right, you know, being 100% right, how much chance of success does that buy you?
Right.
You know, and I just put it out there. I was hoping, and I was, you know, all but literally pinching myself when the March 2nd ruling came down. I have not followed the Keith Davis Jr. case much at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always interesting to find out when you make new law, who the beneficiaries of that new law might be.
I guess at that point Judge Cox was going to set another hearing to discuss the thing that was already discussed.
Well, we were hoping he would just grant the motion for new trial on paper. I mean, at this point, there was no dispute. It's a state law issue. It's not going up any higher. This is the highest court. Mr. Davis is clearly covered under this opinion. He didn't. And I let the court know, we filed this. If the court is inclined to have a hearing, we would like one as soon as possible. I don't want Mr. Davis to be transferred. And then I drove over to Central Booking, and I went to talk to Keith, tell him what was happening, and then got back in my car, and there was an email from the court offering dates, like, at the end of April? And I was like, the end of April? But it's March 2nd. Why would we need to have a hearing at the end of April? And I think there was a couple of days in June that the court had offered. It was really, really far out. And I was like, what? Like, no, we need to have this issue decided immediately. This individual just got sentenced to 50 years, and clearly he's ripe for a new trial. There should be no more delay. And once an individual is sentenced, they're shipped to any part of the state, and that can be really hard to meet with, work with, prep a case with a client who's sitting in Cumberland or Hagerstown a couple hours away, or ECI by the Eastern Shore, which is 3 hours away. So I wanted to prevent that from happening. Plus, it was just the right thing to do. While that motion is outstanding, as soon as it was clear that the court hadn't granted the motion for new trial right away, there was no reason for me to delay filing the appeal.
After the change in Cassati. So did you hear from the state at that point?
What they basically said was, He still doesn't come under it because he's not on direct appeal yet, which is too narrow of a reading of what that means. And number two, he says, and even if he does, it wasn't preserved, which it was preserved. The state did not point out in its brief that the court said it's preserved.
Now listen, the universe may clearly be on Team Keith, but Patrick Seidel played himself. He's been wrong about this starting from the moment he objected and made Kazadian an issue Levy could even pursue. Of course he doesn't want to admit it. Judge Cox has had the motion to reconsider with the corrected order in Kazadi since March 2nd, hours after he denied this issue on grounds that are now officially moot. But you know what? He's up for re-election, and his proposed hearing dates were conveniently after Baltimore was to have voted. The COVID-19 pandemic postponed the election until Tuesday, June 2nd, which is either tomorrow or today, depending on when I finally finish this episode. Cox can still rule on the motion, but I'm not holding my breath. The Office of the Public Defender has already filed their intent to appeal Keith's conviction, and Kazadi will be front and center when they submit their brief to the Court of Special Appeals. Maybe Keith will even get a new trial on several issues. Wouldn't that be sweet? Keith's sentencing hearing feels so long ago instead of just a few months. It was just before the coronavirus pandemic really turned the country upside down and shifted priorities for everyone. By the end of March, Maryland was locked down, including all the courts, and jury trials are still on hold until at least fall. Bail reviews are being held over the phone on conference lines, and defendants aren't even present at all. There's still so much more we have to learn about COVID-19, but two things are abundantly clear. Jails and prisons are not built for social distancing in any way and lack basic supplies, like masks and soap, for stopping the spread of the virus. Many of the people who are locked inside, who have no choice but to be there, are at high risk of contracting and dying from COVID-19. Keith is one of those people.
There's no question that Keith suffers from moderate to severe asthma. In other words, I've seen him in great physical distress from his asthma. I have people in my family with asthma. I've had clients with asthma. And a lot of times people can have sort of generally controlled mild asthma. And Keith mm-hmm. has really horrible asthma flares. And I have now known him long enough that I can see when I'm talking to him when he's wheezing and gasping for breath. So I've actually seen it firsthand. CDC has said that people with asthma were at heightened risk for severe complications from COVID-19, I wanted him to be not in a place where he had no ability to socially distance. So we filed for an appeal bond for him in the trial court, an emergency bond for him to get out, and understanding that the nature of his charges would make it difficult for a judge to agree to release him, I asked only for the specific period of time at least for the virus to pass, because as we were filing these, there were no protections being taken. He had a stranger living in his cell with him. There's lots of research that viruses like this one that are highly contagious, that jails and institutions were at heightened risk of transmission. Really, they're not even allowed to call their family members at the beginning. They didn't have masks in the beginning. There was no testing. They're not protected by the corrections officer. So it was just frightening. So right. We immediately filed many petitions to get anybody. We went immediately for our vulnerable clients first. Let's try to get all of our vulnerable clients out of jail. And he clearly was one because he suffers from asthma.
In a matter of days, COVID-19 can kill a young, healthy, non-incarcerated person with money, healthcare, and tons of resources. While the response to the virus from criminal justice stakeholders has varied wildly across the country, in Baltimore, the trend seems to be compassion for nonviolent offenders, while people charged with any sort of so-called violent crime aren't worth the risk of release. Levy sought to have Keith temporarily released on home monitoring, which would involve being inside 24/7, at Kelly's house, obviously. Mandatory social distancing sounds great to me. The state opposed, though, and Keith was denied. Kelly, who was obviously terrified, urged Levy to keep fighting.
After Keith was denied home release and you guys appealed, you have to file for the appeal bond first in the trial court. And if it's denied, then you filed. So it wasn't technically an appeal. It was a new petition for an appeal bond. And your petition for an appeal bond addressed the fact that his conviction was poised to be vacated.
Well, it's by rule, we have to address particular factors under the appellate appeal bond rule. And the first factor is likelihood of success on appeal. So you have to address it.
That's not the same rule in the trial court. We don't have to address that factor when we're asking for the appeal bond, but you do in the appellate court. So they're just doing their job. We did ours and they did theirs.
The Attorney General's office remanded the request for bond back to Judge Philip Jackson, who denied release originally. And they ordered him to hold another hearing and issue a decision that was consistent with the order from Judge Barbera of the Court of Appeals.
Typically, the court has to consider these what we call 4216 factors. So it's Rule 4-216.1, and that's the factors on flight risk and risk to public safety. But we sort of found it ironic that we were starting all these bail proceedings with, we are in an emergency, people are dying, this is a horrible time, so nobody's here, no defendants are here because it's too dangerous. And then they would go into the bail hearing. At the time of Keith's first hearing, Judge Barbera from the Court of Appeals had issued her subsequent ruling, which basically said, look, in addition to the 4216 factors, you really need to consider a lot of other additional information. Is the defendant vulnerable? Is the facility in which they are housed capable of helping them? What is the real threat to letting them go? So the court mandated these other factors. We were already arguing them. We were prepared to address all of those issues, whether he was a flight risk or a threat to public safety. And we felt like both of those factors weighed in his favor. Mr. Davis does not have a significant criminal history, but for this conviction. So what's left?
I fully expected that the state's argument was going to be that he's, you know, a flight risk or that he was too dangerous to let out, et cetera. That seemed super obvious. I have to say that I don't know if I'm naive, but I did not quite expect that the state would argue that Keith's health issues are not actually serious.
I mean, that was really concerning because we had all been present physically at the hearing that was postponed for Mr. Davis's asthma. We were brought into chambers. The corrections officers told us his asthma took a turn for the worse and that they rushed him back to central booking because they were concerned. I mean, I've seen him over the course of the last couple years with his inhaler in his hand, and I'm sure they have. Like, that was really a struggle for me to wrap my brain around how they could possibly come in and say, oh, and yeah, there's some notation in some record that he didn't report having asthma to some preoperative intake, and so he really doesn't have it. I mean, even if somebody saw that on a paper that was produced by somebody a few years ago in a preoperative note, that was hearsay, surely the evidence that people observed with their very own two eyes in court, that the judge, you know, causing the hearing and the corrections officers who were trained made judgments about, like, clearly that would have trumped this two-year-old preoperative note filled out by somebody else. I'll never understand that. I mean,
yeah,
really? Is, I guess, the only, really? You saw the guy in physical distress, and right before that, in the motion for new trial hearing, I could see him wheezing, you can see retracting, and you can sort of see at the face of his neck, you can see like how he starts having really short breaths and their labor. And it's really hard to watch. And I could see it in the hearing. And I turned to him while we were at the bench and I said, are you okay? Are you having trouble breathing? And he doesn't want to leave the hearing. So he says, you know, I'm okay. But everybody heard that. I mean, right there. And that was the same prosecutor who argued that he didn't really have asthma. He presented, he didn't even admit it into the record, was his jail call where some individual who he claimed was Mr. Davis bragged about having worked out. And that that meant that even if Mr. Davis has asthma, it certainly couldn't be bad, which just is a misunderstanding of asthma. So, I mean, that doesn't even really bear responding to. And certainly asthma can turn on a dime. Very sadly, people die of, you know, asthma attacks that came out of nowhere all the time. And everybody knows that. That's just a common sense fact.
Sometimes I wonder if it's really like a misunderstanding of asthma or if he understands perfectly well and he'll just pretend otherwise because he does not care.
Well, it doesn't make a difference to us one way or another because it's really just whether the court buys it.
I suppose you can't spend too much time thinking about whether these people are evil, but I think about it all the time.
He concluded on the record that Keith was vulnerable, but never addressed, you know, the facility. And the court never really said why they think he's a threat to public safety. There was a video of him on social media last night. His wife was able to have a video visit with him.
Yeah.
And he's wearing a mask, so he is doing well currently. He is not sick at this moment. So that is good news. I mean, thank goodness he's doing well today. But at the time, we really just didn't know. And you are in a complete state of panic when you have a client locked up behind bars that you cannot see in person, you can't get in there, they can't talk to their family, and hundreds of I mean, and thousands of people around you all over the world are dying. Mm-hmm. So that is like something I've never experienced before. And I mean, we were all, you know, you're up at night and you feel like you can't breathe because you have all these people relying on you to try to save their lives and get them out.
Even though Keith wasn't released to home monitoring, filing the appeal bond resulted in a rather pleasant surprise. The Office of the Attorney General, in their response, also addressed the likelihood that Keith's appeal would be successful. In early May, before anyone on Team Keith had any clue, Kelly sent an urgent message to Team Keith, asking everyone who was around to join a last-minute meeting on Zoom, one of those video conferencing apps that's holding professional and personal relationships together during the COVID-19 quarantine. Familiar faces began to fill the virtual conference room, lining up like tiles at the top of the screen. The last time many of us had seen each other was 2 months earlier in Judge Sylvester Cox's courtroom for Keith's sentencing hearing. I'll let Kelly take it from here.
Some really good news. The AG's office, they're saying that they are conceding on the appeal, that they will not fight the appeal because they agree that he would have won with the Kazadi issue.
What? So they I'm going to cry. What?
Look at your face.
Yeah. Jesus Christ.
Brian Frosch's office is saying, we're laying down our sword. We're not fighting. We agree with you. He would have won.
I'm just numb. I don't even know how to react.
I don't know what I just peed my pants.
I know.
I can't jump anymore.
I was so scared it was going to be like horrible news or something. I was so nervous.
This is incredible, Kelly.
This is fucking awesome.
You must be so excited and relieved and like faith restored and all of that. Amazing.
Yeah.
Does Keith know?
Keith does know. He has known. Yes, he's known. I don't think he believed it. Kelly, you're crying.
This is unreal.
I'm going to go shriek outside Mosby's house.
50 years is gone. Might not have told y'all. Every day I would cry at night and be like, God, what am I going to do for 50 years? Like, how? They went a step further and said, like, no, we not only agree with you. This was only supposed to be for him to get out on medical release. They didn't have to say we could see we're not going to fight you. You know, they could have dragged it out and they didn't. So I was really, really, really excited. How are you celebrating? Because this is cause for a motherfucking celebration.
Thank you for listening to another update episode. Thank you so much to Rabia, Susan, Colin, Methol, Hannah, everybody, all the listeners so much for supporting Keith and Kelly and keeping up with this case. I hope everyone out there is doing okay. Wear masks, wash your hands, love your friends, love your family. Thank you so much also to Steve Klepper for everything you've done. I know you had no idea that it would help the Keith case, but thank you. Thank you so much to Keith's attorney, Debbie Levy. This was a pleasure to be able to talk to you about all these aspects of Keith's case. And I know you don't do interviews very much, but I hope it made it worth your while. Thank you so much, too. I cannot forget to thank Team Keith, who are the best people ever. And Kelly Davis, who is probably the coolest person I know. Thank you to Undisclosed Sponsors for keeping the lights on and making it possible for them to give me the occasional episode. I super duper appreciate it. And I guess thank you to everybody else. Free Keith Davis. Woo!
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.